Find out what's on in our city on ORFM's Dunedin Community Notice Board. Go to oar.org.nz and look for the link. You're one click away from up-to-date community event listings, and you can post your own notices free of charge.
This programme was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Each week we talk with someone who's making a positive difference, who is seeing the world through something resembling a sustainable lens. And tonight's sustainable lens is that of Brian Scott from the Otago Regional Council. He's the chair of the Regulatory Committee.
That's right.
But let's start with you first. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up
in Balclutha, south Otago. I was born at the local hospital beside the mighty Clutha River. And, I lived there until I was 18 when I disappeared off to university. Do you want me to talk a bit about my time in south Otago? What would you like me to talk about?
I'd like to talk about what you wanted to be when you grew up.
Oh, jeepers, the difficult questions. I'm still trying to figure it out, to be honest with you. What did I want to be? Look, you know, we all have our different role models, don't we? Look, my father was a builder, my father was a farmer, my father was an engineer, and I think the reality is, you know, we're always tainted with a bit of that. I was probably a little bit conservative. I walked paths that had been previously walked. Probably wanted to be an All Black too, for everyone to know. All those types of things. I had passions. I had fun. I loved my tramping. I could have gone down that path. But, you know, we were south Otago is a typical New Zealand community. Excuse me a minute. You know, everybody's working hard. You look for an opportunity that provides an income and some security and some interest and some passion. Yeah.
And you eventually went off to be an engineer?
I had an older brother that studied. I actually might need to grab a drink of water or something. Have you got anything at all here, Sam? I'm starting to...
Let's put some music on while we do that. Let's bring this back up. And we're back with Brian Scott.
Yeah. Hey, apologies about that.
Now with a glass of water.
Exactly. All I needed was a drink out of the mighty Clutha and I was away again until I start choking on my biscuit or something like that. You asked me what I wanted to be. Look, I wasn't quite sure. I actually went to Canterbury University. I thought that was an interesting and challenging thing to do. I enrolled in a degree in chemical and process engineering. And ultimately, through perseverance and hard work, I was successful in that. It still didn't determine what I wanted to be, but I think the key thing was that I met some really interesting people. I pushed my limits. I learnt a few things. And it wasn't a bad platform for the future.
And were you just following, as you said, roads that had already been trod, or did you have a particular vision in mind?
I think I was... I think at that time I was just probably keeping everybody happy. You know, I was keeping myself happy to a degree. You know, like I love my sport, I love the outdoors, and I was meeting interesting people. What was wrong with that? You know what I mean? You get a tick in the box, everybody's sort of happy. And in the end, I sort of landed up with a qualification. And I went to Otago University afterwards, a number of years afterwards. I sort of landed up with a qualification that I tried to use or use as a platform to open any door that I wanted to go through. And I've worked in lots of different fields, and I think to sort of reflect that. Yeah.
I pushed you through the growing up part in South Otago.
I didn't like that,
South Otago.
I'm sorry about
I'm
that.
I'm coming back to it.
Oh, good.
So, growing up in South Otago.
Yeah. Okay. While I was, you know, a lad, a male, it was all about sport, really. I still bump into some of my friends and, you know, from those days, and we used to play tennis, we used to play rugby, we used to play football. We used to do everything. I was in the boys' brigade, I was in the brass band, I was in the madrigals, I was in the choir. In fact, somebody must have had a plan, keep that lad busy. Because the wheels did fall off when I was younger, and I think keeping busy wasn't a bad strategy. So I think for a male, South Otago, you know, ticked a lot of the boxes. I think for a female, it was probably less so, less cultural and so forth, but we gave it a good damn crack. Yeah. In terms of my family, you know, as I said before, we had a farm which was covered in bush and which we slowly developed over 20 years. My father's parents sold that. And I think in a lot of ways that sort of shaped who I am. Out into the wilderness, working hard, a bit of freedom, you know, all these types of things. And these are the things that sort of inspire me a bit today, I suspect, in terms of expectations and vision, and ultimately probably what makes me happy.
Did you think at that time, and not as precise as I'm going to go and, you know, be a regional councillor?
Yeah.
But did you see that there was sort of work to be done beyond the professional or in a business?
Not really. Look, you know, the place that I grew up in, you know, in terms of agriculture and the environment, it was all about relatively low intensity, you know, traditional, historical sheep farms, cattle farms, this type of thing, you know, where the animals would drink out of the local stream, without too much of an impact. You know, in terms of my connection to the regional council, that was later. That was later. My initial goals when I was, you know, younger, is, you know, sport, the outdoors, fun, you know, this type of thing. And then later in my 20s, I did a business degree, and I thought, I don't have any money. I need to get some money. I went overseas, worked in London, did all that type of stuff. You know, really focused on working hard, making money, business. And that's what it was all about, basically, other than bits and pieces in the outdoors, North Wales, this type of thing. So it was all financially focused. And after a period of time when I'd achieved certain goals, I thought, well, that's that. I've had enough of that. and then you look around, you say, well, you know, at that time I was moving into I'd got married, family, thinking, well, you know, what's next? You know, come back to New Zealand, you know, build a house. I got a little bit politically active just through the, you know, the kids. You know, like I coached in a soccer team for 10 years, all the kids and my nieces, my nephews and all this. Then on to the Board of Trustees for 10 years. And then you're looking at the environment, you know, around you in terms of the way it was, the way you remember it. And I think, like myself, a lot of times, you know, tramping, climbing, mountaineering. So you're seeing the best of the environment, and you come back and you see, you know, the intensification, the impact, and the regional responsibilities. And that's what I thought. I wonder what this regional council is all about, you know, as opposed to coming to that conclusion when I was a teenager. Or you see different things in life, don't you, at different times.
Your one of your regional council colleagues, Neville Peat.
Yeah.
He, well, when he was on the show, he talked about how every generation unwittingly accepts a degradation of nature because it's, they don't know that it was better before them.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, well, I do know. You know, I do know, and I read, and I feel, and I see, you know, an experience. You know, you go to a place like Fiordland, you know, these wonderful areas that we've set aside to reflect the past, and then you see, you know, the changes in the streams, the changes in the agriculture, the changes in the attitude, going from, you know, a family farmer community situation to more of a business orientation. And these are gross generalizations, but nevertheless, they have had their, you know, ecological impact, and that's a fact.
That you talked about how the relationship between agriculture and the environment when you were young,
yeah,
it was low intensity,
yeah,
and so
accepted.
We got away with what we were doing.
Yeah.
Is it the same practices but ramped up? Is that where we've lost some of the control that we've tried to maintain what was working before? But when we've increased the intensity of it, stopped working? Is it this?
I think the answer to that is yes, but it is a gross generalization as well. Like you will find people doing sustainable practices, you know, doing all, you know, wonderful things, you know, keeping things in sort of balance. And their financial situation might have a little bit to do with that. They may have inherited the farm, taking it on, just carrying the practice, or they may have bought the farm and have inherited a debt, and therefore they're a lot more economically, you know, focused. I mean, like, it's interesting in Otago, for example, you probably find that 20% of the farms have 80% of the negative impact, and 80% of the farms are actually doing okay, Jack. And what the heck are you on about, Brian Scott? You know, but those 20% have a huge impact. You know, so for example, without jumping into it too quickly, you know, like a typical dairy farm, for example, has the same ecological impact as a community of 10,000 people. Am I jumping too far ahead in this conversation?
No. Good. It doesn't matter. We can go all over the show, but okay. Let's come from steps back.
Yeah.
So you trained as an engineer.
Oh, we're back there.
I'm going back there. And we don't need to step through every role, but
no.
it's an engineering,
yeah,
process engineering. Yes. It's industry.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. The funny thing is, why did I pick chemical and process engineering? It was quite similar to the dozen people the same type of rationale as the dozen people I used to sort of hang out in that particular class. And it wasn't so much that I ticked the box that said chemical and process engineering. It was that the fact that I put a cross on all the other boxes. and that was the only box left that said engineering, a little bit academic. And you think, well, I wonder what this is all about. And before you know it, you've jumped off the board.
You're lucky there wasn't a class that said pole dancing.
Actually, maybe there was. Maybe I should have. And the interesting thing is, like, we're here in Community House. So my first job as a graduate was just, if you follow the old chocolate smells, you know, at Cadbury, I was their process engineer as a graduate, probably early 20s, and that was a bit of fun. But I will, before you start, and tell me to stop talking, please. But the thing about this training is it didn't necessarily make me a good engineer, but it did teach me how to disseminate technical information and to establish a process and just think in a reasonably sort of analytical and methodical sort of way. And that's what it taught me. And I believe that stood me in good stead as a counsellor.
I was going to say, what's the essence of, you know, being an engineer? And I know that you still do have a real job.
Yeah.
Being an engineer. But what can you take from that to something such as being a counsellor?
Yeah. Okay. Well, my main role is really not as an engineer. It's actually as a project manager that builds upon my engineering experience, you know, in the engineering field. So can I push that over to, you know, project management? So it's about, you know, dealing with people. It's about establishing a vision and trying to achieve it. It's about doing the simple things well. It's about, you know, as a project manager, being accountable for cost, time, quality, all these types of things. So, and if you compare that with a counsellor who's just one of a team, but nevertheless, you know, thinking exactly about these type of things, not necessarily from a operational management, but from a governance, and they, you know, yeah, and I think they're complementary. It was quite interesting. I had a job. I worked for a company, Octra Associates, that does a lot of consultancy work, you know, for the Dean City and this type of thing. And I remember when I came back from the UK, where I worked for myself in the UK, but I came back here and I got this job with Octra Associates, and I was one of the project managers on this project, the Green Island Wastewater Treatment Plant, 94, 95 type of thing. And I remember the councillors coming through, Colin Weatherall, Hudson. Might have been later in the 90s. It might have even been a noon there. You know, I'm not sure. And I looked at them and I thought, hey, these guys are in an important role. I'm sitting here busting my back, you know, trying to do this, that, and the next thing. These guys prance and have a cup of coffee and a biscuit. And how good a job are these guys doing, you know, in terms of the strategic outcomes? And I thought, you know, and I put that in my back of my mind there, I think, at some point. And I thought, I wouldn't mind having a crack at that.
Or you could have put your feet up.
I could have put my feet up. It's not me, though.
So, you know, before you took on this sort of role, what was wrong with the world that needed you to, you know, put your name forward and get off the couch?
Well, we've already talked about one of them, that the world had changed. You know, like, it's a fine balance between economic, you know, prosperity and environmental, you know, degradation. So that's one of them. But I think actually what happened was probably just a little bit more, you know, I'd moved from being a single guy fighting the world, trying to make a bob, sort of tick that box a little bit, and then I went into the family thing. So you start to look at, you know, you move into probably more of a nurturing role in a way, where you think, how does this fit, you know, in terms of the environment and responsibility, self-responsibility. So, and I think that was a bit of a driver, you know. And also, I'm keen on having an interesting life as well. So it's not, the funny thing is about the counsellor thing, you know, is that on one hand, you're giving, you know, you're giving your time, you're giving your knowledge to the best of your ability. But on the other hand, you're taking, you're learning, you're in a little bit of a privileged situation. Ideally, you know, the environment is going to be better for your input. Ideally, you are going to be a little bit better for your involvement as well. Yeah. So it's sort of a, yeah.
Those attributes, things like the essentially the caring, the nurturing, the self-responsibility, yeah, that you're talking about, how come it took having their family to get that. Could you see a way that that could be a requirement of engineering?
Yeah, I think that's right, but I also think you do go through different stages in your life, you know. Yeah, it's sort of funny. We all have different personalities. I'm trying to learn Te Reo, and we did a little analysis last night in terms of, you know, in terms of our personality profiles. And, you know, it really sort of came down to the crunch. I was quite sort of orientated earth, air, as opposed to water and fire, you know, quite sort of focused. You know what I mean? So maybe it did take a family to snap me into reality.
So on the council.
Yeah.
What is it that you bring to the council? No, I've got a better question. I'm going to ask first.
That wasn't a bad one.
I think I'm going to ask that one anyway. Why does the council exist?
Yeah. Okay. You could probably get 50 people lined up out the door and say that's a damn good question. But like, why do we exist? You know, like, we're sitting in here in the community house because, you know, this is part of a community thing in terms of services, and that's where, for example, the Dunedin City sits in terms of the territorial authority, in terms of providing services, you know, in terms of this community house, in terms of the rubbish, in terms of the library, this type of thing. Why does the regional council exist? It's there in terms of the resources of the region, and they have a governance and a management responsibility in terms of sustainability. Can they do it on their own? Of course they can't, but they have a key role. So, for example, water quality in terms of not the water quality that we drink, thanks for the glass, by the way, but in terms of the water in our streams, this type of thing, in terms of, like, we're going through a process at the moment in terms of minimum flows in the stream, these types of response. You can't just leave it to the person that is the stroppiest and wants to take. You know, there is some management, some balance that's required. There's some regulation that's required, all this type of stuff. Yeah, so it's resources, flood protection, let's not talk about the buses, but, you know, all these type resources, that's what the regional account, that's why it exists.
Okay, now I'll ask the question, what do you bring to that council?
I thought we got around that question.
No.
well,
I was just giving it some context.
Okay, well, that's interesting. You see, like, basically there's 12 councillors on the council. Typically half of them are farmers or, you know, current or ex or whatever. So I come to the council. I always put myself forward, you know, with a number of hats. Well, when I first started, I was a young guy with the family, which was a little bit unique in terms of the age profile. I'm an engineer, project manager, and we've talked about that. I also, you know, I've been a member of the New Zealand Alpine Club for, you know, 20-odd years. So in terms of that wilderness and experience and expectation, and also myself and my brothers, we have a forestry, we're forestry, and which is, you know, also, you know, part of that whole agricultural commercial realm of the region.
Is it to your advantage, or maybe it unnerves people, that this apparent guy from the city can talk farm?
Yeah, a lot of, you know, when it comes to politics, that's an interesting one. You know, people have pretty thick skins, and they sort of put their head down and they sort of bulldoze forward, you know, and all sort of. It might unnerve them, but it doesn't seem to stop anybody doing what they're doing, you know. I'm just trying to put myself in the best possible position to add some value. And I tell you, that's what I do try to do. Like I mentioned before, in terms of Okta Associates, where I worked as a project manager and a consultant. Any meeting I go to, any meeting you go to, you've got to turn up with 3 or 4 points of significant value, you know, where the client says, right, I just remembered why that person sitting at the table that we're paying X dollars per hour and all this. And I tried to do the same as a counsellor. So I read everything that's given to me, and every report, I'll have something to think about, something to say. And in fact, you know, I think, you know, some counsellors might tell me that I say too much.
What does success look like for the council?
That's an interesting question. What does success look like? I've been on the council for quite a period of time, and particularly initially, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about things like that in terms of policy and visions and plans and so forth. And what success looks like at the moment is basically being successful with the plans that are in place. We've got a lot of plans that are in place. Yeah, we have to keep updating them and so forth, but we've got some key milestones. So I tell you what success looks like. In 2020, you know, we're making farmers accountable in terms of the runoff from their land. Success looks like that, you know, 80% of these farmers are actually tracking in the right direction, and that we're actually trending to a successful outcome where people are taking responsibility and it's only a very small minority that are not doing what they need to do. Success, you know, looks like having a minimum flow in the river, that despite, you know, having irrigators and so forth, that the river ecological and community needs and everybody's needs, economic and so forth, are all met, not to the detriment of the environment. That's what success, you know, it's going to Alexandra and being able to breathe good air and have a warm home in the middle of winter. That's what success looks like. Having people with smiles on their faces and good health statistics and welfare and so forth, that's what success looks like.
See, that sounds like a positive vision.
Yeah.
But when you hear people in the media, you know, the RMA, the regional councils are just say no to everything, they're in the way. those two visions don't sit nicely together.
Well, that's actually interesting, actually, because, and I was one of the councillors that used to say no, no, no. You know, like my heritage is Scottish, you know, we like to do good things, but within a budget. You know, that was the project management thing, you know, like get a good outcome but achieve it in the budget and so forth. And we, you know, the regional council had employed 100 staff. The CE at the time, you know, was a hydrologist, and that was where and with a history of catchment boards, and that's where our focus was, and that's where a lot of work needed to be done in the realm of water. So what it basically meant was that was our focus, whereas the community for years would turn up and say, well, you're a significant organisation, you've got deep pockets, you know, why aren't you involved in this, this, this and this? And we would say no, 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 and we were mean-spirited. And we didn't hold up a hand in our community. We're going through a process at the moment where we're saying yes, 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 yes. And I just hope we can deliver on that. And I'll be certainly, and I don't say that in a negative way, I say it in a responsible way, that we've opened the door and let's deliver.
Because those smiling faces are not just about the environment. It's, then you're not going to achieve smiling faces by doing less bad. You need a positive, thriving vision as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, yeah.
So your role, chair of the regulatory committee, what does that mean?
Well, what does that actually mean? What that means is that I have a governance responsibility, that there's a significant proportion of the council business is regulatory. That means compliance, that means rules, that means compliance officers getting out and about and saying, hey, we've got a problem here, we've got a water pollution problem, or hey, we've got too many rabbits over here, or all these types of, whether it's pests, whether it's air quality, water quality. Basically, if there's a regulation, if it's broken, you know, or maybe the consenting regime, you know, so if you want to do something, you know, what's the impact on the environment? Is it sustainable? All that type of stuff. And so I'm not involved in the management of that, but what that means is that I keep in regular contact with the director. I make him accountable to him, and I try to inspire him if I possibly can. So what I'm saying to the director at the moment is think strategic, you know, think big picture. If there are issues that we're struggling to resolve, come up with answers and let's do something about it. You know, one of the things I'm doing at the moment is I'm chairing this water quality reference group, which is endeavouring to build up a bit of steam prior to 2020 so that the council is fit for purpose in terms of its water quality plan and so forth. So that's what, you know, the chair of the regulatory means is to get, is to, is assist the realisation of these visions. Yeah. Have I answered your question?
What sort of decisions make it from the staff to, we need councillors to make a decision on this?
Typically policy, you know, like in terms of what's the policy on this situation? What's the policy? Are we going, you know, if it's minimum flows in a river, you know, staff will put together a proposal or whatever. But what's the policy? Where does the council, where does the community sit on it? Does the community expect to have a minimum flow in a river? Does the community expect to have a certain water quality in the streams, and setting those policies on behalf of the community? Now, underlying all of that is obviously the national regulation and expectation, but often that can be weak or not fit for purpose or not local and all this type of stuff. So we're there to... the staff is supposed to be, you know, accountable to the governance direction. They're there to do our bidding.
When you get a decision to make, is it presented in such a way that it is, like the analysis is done and it's sort of like there's an obvious option A?
It's supposed to be. Firstly, it's supposed to be done in a professional way. If it's not done in a professional way, you ask for it to take the report back. Or there's, you know, lots of different outcomes. Or you can come up with your own recommendation, you know, like, but typically, so for example, the Peninsula buses, right? I don't know if you've been following that at all, but okay, so you've got the Peninsula bus situation where the staff were basically saying, for goodness sake, we've got a bus strategy which is about buses being more regular, being more direct, all going to a central hub not too far away from here. Whereas actually the Peninsula bus people said, well, you know, why can't you just go over here and stop the bus at Tahuna or whatever? The staff recommendation was very strong. I was one of the ones that basically, you know, I agreed with the staff, but to a point, and then there was a community 1,000 people survey, and I thought, and they came up with a compromise solution, and I thought, you know, I've been thinking with my head, now it's the time to think with my heart as well, and I changed my vote with Councillor Neil. And that was quite critical to getting that outcome. So yeah, we've all got our role.
Do sometimes you get presented with a wicked problem? We don't actually know what to do here. There's two legitimate possibilities, and we don't know.
Oh, well, they're all like that. And you have to make a decision. Some of the worst situations I've been in is... I remember it might have been... I think it was the... it was either the building debate or the stadium debate, and they ask for a division, you know, where you have to actually say where your vote's going to be, and they started. I'm Scott at S, you know, so you get to hear what everybody else is doing. And I still hadn't made up my mind on this critical vote, and you know, my head was saying one thing, my heart was saying one thing, and in the end, I actually. You know, Kat said, Scott, you know, I still hadn't made up my mind.
Were you counting on the way through?
No. In the end, I went with my heart. You know, I changed, you know, I swung from what I'd been previously doing because I try to keep an open mind in terms of, you know, we don't go along there just to, well, I hope. I expect people to go along and to listen to the debate. The outcome, you know, from the debate of 12 people, ideally is not, you know, 12 times 1. Ideally, it's a number greater than that, that we can keep building upon ourselves, that the output might be the equivalent of, you know, X number of people. So the debate, you know, is not about me just talking to myself in the corner and then putting my hand up. The debate is to get a better outcome.
In those terms, in terms of getting a better outcome, if you could wave a magic wand or start from scratch, is this the right model for making those sorts of decisions?
Well, that's that's really interesting. You know, it sounds a little bit like the RMA, you know, conversation and stuff. Is it the best model? I actually think it's not a bad model. You know, people, you know, often, you know, try to change different things. But I think the structure is actually not too bad. But my criticism of it is not so much the structure. It's, are the people at the table truly representative of their community? And I think you'd definitely have to say no. You know, like, so for example, at the current council, I think we've got three, out of the 12, there's three females, which is more, you know, than there's ever been in terms of my time at the council. But that, you know, that's three less than the 50% that should be six. The youngest person, you know, age would probably be early 30s. And then there's a 40, and then there's a few in the 50s, quite a few in the 60s, you know, the odd one approaching 70. You know what I mean? Like, you can hardly say that that's the average age of our community. Half of them are farmers. You know, what's all that about? This is a regional organisation that's representative of the region, that has deep pockets and has an environmental responsibility. What's all that about? So I think, you know, as some have said, well, you know, that's democracy. You'll end up with what you'll end up with. But I actually think that younger people and different, you know, culturals, whatever, they just might need some support. They might need to be asked, what's it really going to take for you to put your hand up? Or does it come back to the original question that you asked me, that it, you know, took me to move into the nurturing mode for myself to, you know, get engaged? Maybe younger people just got other things to think about. But it's not representative, and the structure ain't bad. I shouldn't say and.
So why aren't Generation Zero type young activists seeing this as a body that's making a difference?
Well, I think if a young person stands, I think typically young people don't vote, you know, so you've got to get them voting. You've got to somehow get them engaged, you know, like maybe, you know, a young person's sort of got to figure it out that, hey, here's a vehicle for young people to maybe achieve some reasonable outcomes for the environment, for them personally, whatever it is. You know, there's, I don't know, what's it take? What's it take to get people focused? I'm not sure.
Is the council actively engaged in engaging the community? Is that something the councillors talk about?
It's certainly something that councillors talk about. It's certainly something that the council's getting better at. But, and I think, look, if you flick through the ODT over the last month or two, you'd see, what is this ORC thing that keeps coming out? It's actually, you know, page three, page two, now page one on lots of different issues. And so, for example, one of the things the ORC is doing better is that it's pushing out information. And I think newspapers are grabbing this and saying, hey, actually, this is interesting. This is actually important. So we are trying to connect to a community. We've been saying that for as long as I've been on council. But I think we're now actually starting to do it a bit better. after saying that, myself as a counsellor, you know, I could bump into lots of different people and they'd have no idea that I was a counsellor. Maybe I'm kidding myself on that one. I used to say that I could run down George Street, you know, naked, and nobody would realise that I was actually a counsellor on the ORC. Do you think that's right, Sam, or not?
The ODT would probably pick it up, and then they would. But you are actively going out and doing things like the is it called second stage or the Love the Leith?
Yeah.
You know,
of course
you're having to work quite hard to get those sorts of things out.
Oh, definitely. And I tell you what, anybody invites me to anything, I'll go to it. And I love it, and that's what we're there for. And after saying that, I'm not there just to, you know, kiss babies and eat scones. I'm hoping that throughout all this that by getting people engaged that they will start to care a bit better about their environment and their community and about the outcomes, and so that we can actually you know, have a step towards some of those visions.
What's the state of Otago's water?
The state of Otago's water sits into two camps, and I'm not happy about it, you know, but you go to, you know, the hinterland, the lakes, the Great Lakes, and the ORC will beat its chest and say, isn't that water wonderful? And of course it is, you know, from the glaciers and so forth. After saying that, you've got things like Lake Snow and Didymo that have been introduced that have raised their head. And that's a little bit indicative of, you know, the general greying of our environment, you know, internationally as people travel. Somebody said to me recently that maybe the Didymo and the Lake Snow introduction could have come from the same one incident, in terms of one fisherman from Canada turning up in a particular stream or lake, you know, fishing around New Zealand, I don't know, 30 years ago. So what's the state of our water? So even the pristine stuff has got some challenges. Now, we started this off saying I'm from South Otago. Well, South Otago is doing particularly badly in terms of water quality, and that's a reflection of the intensive agriculture. It's a reflection on, you know, the pioneering spirit that's there. People work hard and bulldoze through, but they don't necessarily have the resource or the technical understanding to manage it properly. And before they even know it, there's issues. Can we turn this around? I damn well hope so.
You said yourself that your family farm was covered in bush and you developed it over the time.
Go,
I presume that means take the bush off.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I've got 9 hectares. It's all covered in broom and I'm trying to grow native bush on it slowly, not very well. And people look at me as if I'm crazy, you know. But the ecological, you know, the birds, the bees, all this stuff, it needs that wilderness. That's right. The unintended consequence. Even forestry, which I'm involved in, Pinus radiata, for all my talk, you know, we planted that when I got back from overseas, early 90s, mid-90s. And, you know, like on one level, it's quite good in terms of, well, it's not putting effluent in the streams, put it that way, but it is quite one-dimensional in terms of the ecology, you know, like it's the bird life is not what it naturally could be and stuff like that. And there are issues when it comes to milling in terms of sedimentation and so forth. But so, you know, I'm not sure, you know, like Pinus radiata forestry, I'm not sure what you'd mark it at a 10. What would you mark it at a 10 for ecology?
4.
You might give it 5 in terms of, the global carbon issue and the absorption. So you might give it 5. You might even give it 5.5, but it's not perfect, is it? It's not as good as if it was native. It's way off what native is. Okay, maybe it is 4.5.
I've got some questions to end with. What's your go-to definition of sustainability?
Well, it I mean, what I'd typically say is that it's there for our children, and that's what, and you know, there's a bit of emotional with that. But the reality is, in some areas, is that we actually need to do better than that. You know, the status quo ain't good enough. We actually need to get back to what we've said on the council, for example, in water quality, is that water quality needs to achieve certain limits, and once it achieves those limits, it's then sustainable for the future. So, you know, that would be my definition, is to get our environment back in harmony and balance.
How close is the council to accepting a regenerative definition?
The council, you know, their 6A water plan, for example, has limits in it for water quality. And in 2020, farmers are accountable to that. They're actually accountable to parts of it now in terms of sediment. So the council is on board with that. After saying that, the rubber's about to meet the road, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Yeah, as a councillor or as a person?
Let's go for both.
I think the big one, you know, I said before, is that I actually think on this water quality thing, look, I've been banging my head against a brick wall on this water quality thing, and I've been saying that certain things. I've been writing little brief reports. I've been saying the same thing over and over again, and now we've set up a reference group, you know, actually acknowledging that things are not where they should be, despite having a plan, and they've made me chair of it. And I've got to deliver on that. So it's a bit early to say the success, but the door remains open. And I take that as, you know, as a bit of a success. One of the key things that I'd like to think that I, you know, bring to the council is I really do try to make the council accountable. You know, I think, you know, of myself, I try not to think of myself as a councillor so much as a member of the council. More as a member of the community. So I try to make things accountable and so it's just not sitting there taking rates, it's actually delivering.
Do you sometimes feel as though you're painting a target on your back doing that? I'm thinking of, you know, the response that someone like Mike Joy gets.
Yeah, but, you know, like I actually see one of my roles, and, you know, and maybe I'm just kidding myself, but if I think something, I say it, and because, you know, and I'm not trying to say I'm not wrong or whatever, because I've thought I probably am, but I certainly feel that the environment needs people to stand up and speak for it, and I'm not afraid to. Yeah, you know, I'm a target on my back, you know, hey, that's what we're here for.
So we're writing a book about these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes.
Yeah.
So what's your superpower? What are you bringing to the good team? What gets you into the mansion?
What gets me into the mansion? Look, you know, I was born in the year of the ox. You know, I like to think I've got a little bit of intelligence, but maybe have, maybe haven't. I'm there. I'm just keeping going. I'm going. I'm trying to generate ideas. I'm trying to do the work. And I don't care who gets the credit for them. I'm just trying to keep things trending in the best direction we possibly can. I'm trying to make people accountable. So I'm the guy in the mansion in the corner. You don't know who his name is. You don't know why he's there. But he's doing his job.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Actually, that's interesting. That's actually quite interesting because I actually see myself a little bit as just Joe Average from South Otago. You know what I mean? But I go to the council table and I see gaps. I see gaps, and the big gap is somebody at one end of the table representing the environment, and that's the slot that I've moved into. Whereas, in fact, that, you know, that's not my background. I'm a farmer's son. You know, from South Otago, I'm an engineer, you know. I mean, I'm a rugby player. You know, in fact, I'm there probably, well, that's in terms of a debate, but I think that goes back to what I was saying before. I think it's more of a reflection, you know, it's a little bit of a reflection of me, but it's also a reflection of the people sitting around me. People, and, you know, people mightn't like me saying that. I mean, we're all well-intentioned, but we all have different backgrounds and different things we bring to the table.
Is there somebody representing future generations?
Well, the youngest on the council now is probably Ella Lawton from Central and Gretchen. And I think, you know, I'm just getting to know Ella. I'm sure she'll do really well. And I've known Gretchen for as long as I've been on council, and she's always been young. And she, from the rest of the council's perspective, she probably always will be. And I think, I think she's you know, trying to avoid, you know, the bullets flying around. And she is doing a great job in terms of
But even that's attitude. Only buying, I suppose it's a different attitude maybe, but it's still only buying us another 10, 15 years of you know, time span in which this decision affects me.
You lost me there.
Well, how does? Yes, they're a bit younger, but they're not like sub zero younger.
They're not 18 or something.
They're not someone that's going to be here in 100 years' time.
Well, none of us are going to be here in 100 years' time.
So, how does that long term scale get brought to the current decision making?
Oh, well, that goes back to your question about sustainability. So, we need plans, we need policy, and we need to stick to them. And we also need attitudes and responsibility. You know, we need cultures. We need to remind ourselves why we're here and what makes us happy and what we need. And you know, I think that's where the Māori, the te reo thing. You know, I'm trying to learn the language. I'm really bad at it because they've got a culture that's been around for a long, long time. And they're trying to remind themselves too. You know, about what makes them feel good, what makes them be vibrant as a community and as a culture. And I think, you know, if we lean on that and we integrate that and we grow with that, I think we've got a chance. I think all that stuff's good. Yeah, don't let me be too negative. There's a lot of good things going on.
So what motivates you?
Oh, that's really interesting. What motivates me? I like to stick up for the underdog. I think that probably motivates me a lot. I like to stick up for the underdog. At the moment, I would see the environment as a bit of an underdog. You know, it needs a hand. I try to do as well as I can.
What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Delivering on these plans at the council. Yeah, like, can we walk the talk? You know, ink on paper is all very well. You know, can we deliver the regulatory grunt? Can we deliver the social and the community input so that people are doing what they need to do? Are we going to, you know, in South Otago, for example, will be a real testing point. You know, are we going to trend down? Or are we going to trend up? What's going to happen?
I've asked this question in a different form, but I'll ask it again anyway. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
A miracle is sort of like what would you do if you won the lotto? I don't know if it necessarily solves anything. One thing I've learnt, I spent a year of my life in India and travelling around these places, is that it's actually... it's actually what's inside you, actually. If you can just work that through, I think all the other stuff will sort itself out. If people are truly good people, they'll sort all this environmental stuff out, all this other stuff, you know, the war stuff, all that.
That sounds like pretty good advice, but I have a question that says, do you have any advice for our listeners? So, do you have any advice for our listeners? It's a free hit because you've just given us one.
Okay, advice for the listeners. I think there's a wonderful environment out there. Get out, embrace it, take some responsibility for it. If there's issues, don't be put off by them. Try to figure out what's the way to succeed, you know, long term. Educate yourself, become good people, all that type of stuff. And hey, I might even try to do some of it myself.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Tonight's guest has been Brian Scott, who is a Otago Regional Councillor. He's the Chairman of the Regulatory Committee. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
Find out what's on in our city on ORFM's Dunedin Community Notice Board. Go to oar.org.nz and look for the link. You're one click away from up-to-date community event listings, and you can post your own notices free of charge.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.